Genesis chapter 3. You'll get there about the time I leave, if you turn. Now the serpent was more subtle than any beast of the field, which the Lord God had made. And he said unto the woman, and you all know the story of the fall. There was somebody there messing up Eden. Now go to the book of Revelation. Chapter 20. And you can say you've heard Gene Scott preach from Genesis to Revelation. I saw an angel come down from heaven, having the key to the bottomless pit. Serpent is mentioned in Genesis, and it's mentioned again here in Revelation. And he laid hold on the dragon, that old serpent, which is the devil and Satan, and bound him 1,000 years and cast him into the bottomless pit, and shut him up and set a seal upon him that he should deceive the nations no more, till the 1,000 years should be fulfilled, and after that, he must be loose for a little season. And then, in that little season, after the millennium, he'll still be able to find an ear for his deceiving voice in the area, geographically, we now call Russia, and be able to bring down a great host, surround Jerusalem, and on that occasion, after the millennium, which is not Armageddon, Armageddon occurring at the end of the Great Tribulation and before the millennial period, but after that 1,000-year millennium, Satan is loosed from the bottomless pit for a short season, finds a following in, I repeat, the area now occupied geographically by Russia, and will bring this following down and again surround the city Jerusalem. Only on that occasion, fire from heaven will destroy them, and then come the final events of history before God creates new heavens and new earth, and Satan is forever abolished. In between, you have the workings of that old serpent, specifically said, I should correct myself, that he should deceive, in verse 3 of Revelation 20, that he should deceive the nations no more till the 1,000 years is complete. So in between, he's the great deceiver. And he's shut up 1,000 years in what, in the Greek, one word always, the abyss. The abyss in English is a cognate of the Greek word, sometimes translated the pit or the bottomless pit. In between, he's the deceiver. He rules what appear to be earthly thrones. Go to Ezekiel 28. Or write it down to check later. Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, the prophet is saying, Moreover, the word of the Lord came unto me, saying, Now, I think you've probably figured out that I am, for the third Sunday in a row, departing from the book of Galatians temporarily to set a background to the happenings in the current Gulf War and the evil Saddam Hussein. And I will get to him. And to those who think I might be far removed, let me say, I know of no more direct route to Saddam Hussein than the devil. So now you know where we're going. Son of man, take up a lamentation upon the king of Tyrus. An earthly king. You can stand on the high knob of a hill called Mount Carmel, which is really a string of hills above Haifa, and look north directly toward Tyre in southern Lebanon, and that's the area geographically ruled by the person in history referred to as King of Tyrus. But immediately, and this is not the only message about Tyre, because the riches of Tyre have been discussed in the 27th chapter, the commerce of Tyre, the wickedness of their heart. But when he comes to the judgment on Tyrus that he's leading up to, suddenly you're going to see the focus of the prophet go past the earthly ruler to a being so merged with the person of the king of Tyre that though the reference is to the king of Tyre, it quickly becomes apparent the real person that rules Tyre is Satan, that old serpent, himself. He is the king of Tyre, deceiving the nations, wearing the garment and the disguise of this earthly king. It's very clear it has to be this superhuman being, because the message goes on to say, Thus saith the Lord God, Thou sealest up the sum, full of wisdom and perfect in beauty. Thou hast been in Eden, the garden of God. Every precious stone was thy covering, the sardius, topaz, and the diamond, the beryl, the onyx, and the jasper, the sapphire, the emerald, and the carbuncle, and gold. The workmanship of thy tabrets and thy pipes was prepared in thee in the day that thou wast created. Lucifer, son of the morning, Satan, the devil, whatever word you want to use, it's that old serpent in his first shape, remembered in the final beginnings of judgment against him. But he had an existence before he became the deceiver, the father of lies, the devil, Satan, all of his various epithet names. He was known as the crowning cherub, song leader and singer, musician, in the Mount of God. He was in Eden, Now we know he was in Eden as the serpent. But here is a reference to him being in Eden in his previous non-fallen state, when he was the crowning cherub, as the next verse will say. Thou art the anointed cherub that covereth. I have set thee so. Thou wast upon the holy mountain of God. Thou hast walked up and down in the midst of the stones of fire. Thou wast perfect in thy ways from the day that thou wast created, till iniquity was found in thee. He had a created state of being where he led the praises and the worship and the songs to God. God created him with his tabrets and his pipes, his musical ability in him from the beginning. And this is why this is one of the bases for the so-called cataclysmic theory. Between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2, there's a vast gulf of time possible. For the literal has it, in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth. Next verse in the King James, and the earth was without form and void, just as accurately can be translated, and the earth became a waste and a desolation. I'll not take the time to turn to it today, but Jeremiah, the great prophet of God, saw a prophecy in the past tense. When the earth was created, not a waste and a desolation. And he saw on that earth that there was no man, yet there were cities. The Hebrew is a word that literally translates meeting or gathering places for intelligent beings, yet there was no man. So there was on this earth gathering places of intelligent beings, but no man. He then sees a great cataclysm strike the earth, the after effect of which he describes with the exact Hebrew phrase. After this cataclysm strikes the earth, on which there were meeting places of intelligent beings, but there was no man, the earth became a waste and a desolation. This is why you've heard me say many times, and why we send our kids to museums and don't close their mind. Evolution doesn't bother me. It's a theory. Probably apart from Adam, as good a theory as any other theory to explain a sequence of what appears to be progressive development in the strata of the earth. Anyone who studied paleontology, carbon dating, and other methods, speed of light, the fact that light is now reaching us from entities in the galaxies and infinite outness of space, has to conclude that this whole state of reality was not put together 6,000 years ago. And if it was, then it was designed in such a way to create this confusion that reasonable minds would conclude it's much older. And evolution gives no problem to the Christian faith. Most people in science who think that the Bible is wrong are just good scientists in some cases and poor students of the Bible. And there are many biblical teachers who are good Bible students and poor scientists. There is nothing in the Bible to suggest that the earth is only 6,000 years old. The genealogies of Bishop Usher is about as accurate a basis for scientific thought as the same medieval period's viewpoints of a flat earth. The Bible allows a vast, infinite space of time between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2. And in Genesis 1:2, God begins a recreative process. He calls forth herbs. He tells Adam and Eve to replenish the earth, not plenish it. And the King James, seeking in English style to never repeat the same word twice in a sentence, simply distorts the creation of Adam. The record is not that God created Adam and breathed into him and man became a living soul. The literal is God created Adam from the dust of the earth and breathed into Adam, and Adam became a living soul. And it is that whatever it is, undefinable, called soul, that resulted from, in the Hebrew, ruach, which is the breath of God. That breath of God, placed in this, formed by God out of the dust of the earth, being that can be reduced down in chemical elements. When he breathed into Adam, Adam became something different than anything else in the evolutionary process, or whatever the process may be called, that existed up to that time. Adam became something unique because of the breath of God on him, and he became a living soul that let Jesus say, everything else, look at it. What will you give in exchange for your soul? And Adam became something incapable of evolving. Adam became an instant creation because of that quality of God's breath on him that made him a living soul. And you can find man-like creatures all you want. You're never going to find a fossilized soul. Adam was unique. And all this fight about creationism and evolution, God can create by the evolutionary process. But he has said in his word, which said word we take on the authority of Christ, who quoted that book as much as any others, namely Genesis, whose authority was validated by the resurrection, that Adam started something new. And we be descendants of Adam with a living soul that will continue throughout eternity. So there's no problem with true science and proper understanding of the Scripture, because a vast gulf of time exists between in the beginning God created the heavens and the earth, and however many cataclysms have struck the heavens and the earth. In Genesis 1:2, the earth became a waste and a desolation. Darkness covered the face of the deep, and the Spirit of God brooded over it. And he then began a recreative process. And then in the councils of heaven said, let us make, not man, let us make Adam. Go check your commentaries. In our own image. And something new was introduced. Against that backdrop, we now know that Satan, that old serpent, predated Genesis 3. Here in Ezekiel, we have a glimpse of him prior to Genesis 3. He predated Genesis 1, 2. He's in that vast gulf of time, way back in the beginning, when he was created as the functioning, worship-leading song leader and musician of heaven, and was in Eden in some time before the cataclysm, while he was still a favorite crowning cherub in the mountain of God. Now go to Isaiah 14. Again, we have a picture of Satan This happens to be a prophecy not against Tyre, but against Babylon. When he is cast into this abyss for 1,000 years, he will no more deceive the nations. As a great deceiver, he wore the garment of the king of Tyre. But God, with his X-ray vision of prophecy, saw the real ruler of Tyre. And we are then given the benefit of a picture of Satan before his fall, when he had these qualities as a favorite of God and was in Eden, before he appears in the fallen state as the serpent. Now the prophecy is against Babylon, no less. And once again, we see as the prophecy unfolds, it cannot be a mere human. What the eye of prophecy has done is pierced through the deceiving mask of the king of Babylon to the real ruler. Thou shalt, am I boring you?
No, sir.
Thou shalt take up this proverb against the king of Babylon. How timely. And say, how hath the oppressor ceased? The golden city ceased. And by the 12th verse, we're no longer talking about the earthly king. The prophet's eye is now piercing the veil of deceit, the earthly garment, to the real ruler. How art thou fallen from heaven, O Lucifer, son of the morning? Day star. It's what Lucifer means. O day star, son of the morning, how art thou cut down to the ground which didst weaken the nations? For thou, and now we see the reason for the fall of Lucifer or Satan. For thou hast said in thine heart, I will ascend into heaven. I will exalt my throne above the stars. I will sit also upon the mount of the congregation. I will ascend above the height of the clouds. I will be like the Most High. Yet thou shalt be brought down to hell, to the sides of the pit. They that see thee shall narrowly look upon thee and consider thee, saying, is this the man that made the earth to tremble and did shake kingdoms? On the message goes concerning his fall. Now, those who embrace the cataclysmic theory insist that between Genesis 1:1 and Genesis 1:2 is a vast gulf of time. That somewhere between Genesis 1:1, which was after the creation of Lucifer, which goes back to the councils of heaven, Lucifer ruled in his position of being a crowning cherub on the Mount of God in Eden, in the earth that was. In these passages and others, I pick the two most complete ones. There are other many oblique messages in the Psalms and in Job. But in these two paramount passages, plus the Jeremiah past tense vision of the earth having meeting places before there was a man on the earth and a cataclysm striking it and it becoming a waste and desolation as is described in Genesis 1:2, that Satan, having access to heaven, was also king of this earth with angelic beings at his disposal on this earth in Eden before his fall. And he said, I got all this, why shouldn't I have it all? Rebelled against the God of the heavens. And Jesus could say, again, past tense, so it is not the reference in Revelation where Michael casts Satan down and limits him to the earth during the tribulation, that Jesus beheld Satan cast down And a third of heaven's hierarchy of angelic beings were cast in the war of the heavens down, and he became the great enemy of God and the deceiver, and he entered subtly to deceive into the garden. And when God recreated the earth, he gave to Adam dominion, told him to name all of the beings on the earth as a symbol of his authority. Serpent, Satan again in disguise, comes, deceives the woman. She influenced Adam, and Adam and Eve, believing the deceiver, joined him, trusting his word instead of God's word, and their punishment was to lose the dominion over this earth that God had created them to have. And Satan retained that dominion as the prince of the power of the air, still having access to the counsels of heaven, as he did in the book of Job, and still deceiving, knowing that his time will come. But from that fall in the garden until the present time and until the end of time, when he is cast into his abode that God has created for him and his angels, he is the great deceiver who is at war with God and his purposes, the trophies of war being Adam and his descendants created by God, to one day fill the gap of the third of the denizens of heaven that were cast out when Satan and those who followed him rebelled. And that third of heaven will be replaced by the redeemed of all ages, who will sing the song of the redeemed that even the angels cannot join in. And the book of Hebrews has an enigmatic phrase where the writer raises the mystery that God did not bend down to help fallen angels, but has bent down to help fallen man, that we might be the redeemed. Nobody knows the real reason. A hint is suggested by the fact that Satan and his crowd were where we're going and still rebelled. And God, who is redeeming us from his control and the sin of Adam, is going to bring forth those truly stamped with his image because of our faith. And as I've said many times, the earliest man, Adam and Eve, in the sense of defined it today, believed Satan and distrusted God. And from that day until now, this father of lies has sought to destroy faith in God's word, and God is seeking not perfection. He has that in the angels that are with him. He's seeking people who will trust him, as his own dear son trusted him to the cross. And that's the basis of Christianity and the Galatian message. But today, I want to say and put it in at this point. I don't use this except when I think it's practically necessary. I did a PhD at Stanford University. Did an undergraduate major in history. A unit major at the master's level in geology to qualify me to go on with what I thought would be a PhD at Cal in those days in geography. Instead, I shifted to Stanford University, and the only person in their history who has a PhD minor in geography based upon petitioning for an oral exam to qualify me for a PhD minor in geography, never having taken a course in geography at Stanford University, knowing I'd had this previous background. They granted the petition. I'm sure they thought I wouldn't pass the oral exam, but I did. And have the only PhD minor qualifying me to teach geography at the graduate level, and never took a course in geography at Stanford University. That freed me to fill those units that would have been used up, 45 full units, qualifying for a minor at the PhD level in geography. I was able to fill those 45 units up with comparative religion, studying under Spiegelberg, the great expert in Indian religions and philosophy, individual study with Dr. Kishimoto, visiting professor from Tokyo, and doing the PhD cross-departmental in religion and philosophy and education, the PhD granted in philosophies of education, dissertation on the theology of Reinhold Niebuhr. So I'm not your average naive, no mind stretching, and no acquaintance with the threats to faith in normal education in this country. I've already hinted at it when I said I lost my faith, came to a faith because of a study of the resurrection of Jesus Christ, and thus have a faith built on a hard study of a fact of history that most people ignore because it's so unbelievable. And once I could believe the resurrection, I could then accept the authority of the resurrected one, whose own use of the Old Testament places the stamp of his authority on Genesis. But even more apropos, he had to confront this serpent and his servants, the serpent's servants, that is, in his own ministry. And once I crossed the hurdle of belief in the supernatural, that the resurrection of Jesus Christ and his ascension requires, then I have no difficulty. Indeed, it is more logical to assume, based upon Jesus' own representation of himself, having been with the Father, here temporarily, returning to the Father, returning again for us in the last days, to accept the invisible presence of angelic, powerful beings. Indeed, when Peter pulled the sword to fight when the Romans came at the time of his crucifixion, Jesus told him to put the sword away. Not because he's against the sword in all cases, otherwise, why would Peter be carrying the sword? I'm quite sure Jesus knew he carried a sword. There's a time and place for everything. This was not the time to fight. Jesus had already settled it in the garden. This was why he came to die. And he said to Peter, I could call legions, thousands of angels to fight for me. So I don't need your sword in this occasion. In between this angelic favorite of God's who had a prior existence, even a prior existence on earth, who appears in the guise of the serpent, who appears again and again in the guise of the king of Tyre and the king of Babylon and is the deceiver of the nations up until he is cast into the bottomless pit. You see these supernatural, powerful beings working on the stage of history. Simply stated, you can turn to Mark. And as you go through Mark's gospel, and I will not obviously point them all out, but it would be enlightening to just go home after this service, or if you're sitting in your home after this service, to simply read the shortest gospel in the first few chapters. Jesus is baptized of John in Jordan, verse 9 of the first chapter.
straightway coming up out of the water. He saw the heavens opened and the Spirit like a dove descending upon him, and there came a voice from heaven saying, Thou art my beloved Son, in whom I am well pleased.
You think somebody ate some bad food the night before, or that voice actually came out of heaven? Once you accept the resurrection and the validity of Christ, you should have no trouble accepting the truth that God is vindicating and publicly announcing in this miraculous way on his baptism the unique nature of Christ. And the voice from heaven is God's voice, in this case, to be heard by all around. Immediately the Spirit driveth him into the wilderness, and he was there in the wilderness 40 days, tempted. Tempted of Satan. Mark 1. This supernatural being has it out with Jesus there in the wilderness. He has such power. He is able to offer Jesus. Takes him to a high place. Shows him all the kingdoms of this earth. And offers him the power to rule over him if Jesus will just bow down to him. And it was not an artificial offering. Satan could deliver, because except for the chosen seed of Abram and unique sovereign acts of God with select individuals, the whole earth, from Nimrod's day forward, was under the control of the prince of the power of the air. And God chose Abram, elected a people because of Abram's faith, to be his oracle and the custodian thereby of his revelatory purpose, as God is going to seize back from Satan the redeemed of all ages and preserve through this promised people until the seed would come, which is Christ, a way for God to restore his relationship and bring man back to himself. At the time of Jesus' coming, all the nations of the earth, the prince of the power of the air, could deliver. He had his occupying lieutenants in every place. There is a tendency to look on Satan and demons as some homogenized mass. They're not all equal by any means. They are existing in hierarchies. As you watch the various military analysts put their maps of the way Saddam and his troops are dug in, the cannon fodder, the expendable, lice-ridden, undernourished frontline troops are not on the same level as the regular army brigade that stands behind them, mobile in their tanks, who are the ones, by the way, that came down to occupy the unoccupied city, Kafji. Behind them, where so much attention is being given, the Republican Guard, and behind them the hierarchy leading up to Sudan. You have a little embryonic pattern that can be applied to the hierarchy of demons and princes, cleared up to Satan himself. Out of the bottomless pit, I've heard some preach on the devil and call him Apollyon and Abaddon, because during the tribulation, the key will open up, as it will open up to put Satan in. Out of the bottomless pit or the abyss will come forth demons during that tribulation period.
And they will have a leader called Abaddon and Apollyon. Some teachers will tell you that one of the names of Satan's Abaddon and Apollyon. No, it isn't. One of his lieutenants' name is. Satan still has access and has had access to the councils of heaven and is not yet in the bottomless pit to be released during that tribulation period. These are powerful lieutenants that for whatever reason have been put in that bottomless pit. There may even have been some of the princes of Egypt or Assyria or Persia that in past days had ruled over some powerful king of an earthly nation. Satan, when he's cast down, will be cast down by Michael. He had access to the heavens in the case of Job. He certainly had access on the earth because there was a fight, the book of Jude says, over the body of Moses. And Michael, the head prince of the princes under Christ, comes up against Lucifer to confront him in the wrestling over the body of Moses, which has some specific purpose in the plan of God, not revealed. And Michael dares not curse Satan to his face because his punishment for his rebellion was not yet complete, and he still occupied a place of sufficient power and stature and prestige that even Michael, limited by God, cannot curse him to his face yet. In the book of Revelation is one of the last events of the tribulation. Michael is turned loose to cast Satan out of the heavens, and he's restricted in the last days of the tribulation just to this earth, and his hatred intensifies in ratio with his restriction because he knows his end is near and his evil spreads and pervades the earth in those last days. There were many powerful lieutenant chains through the hierarchy. Some were assigned king of Tyre, king of Babylon. And through the king of Tyrus, through the prince under Satan's control that ruled him, through the hierarchy, it ultimately comes to Satan, the real ruler. In this book of Mark, Satan himself takes on Jesus, and he had the capacity to deliver the kingdoms of this earth from Satan and his might down to the foot soldiers that are on the front lines. Jesus went into a synagogue, verse 23. There was in their synagogue a man with an unclean spirit, and he cried out, the deceit again, the difficulty of seeing through the mask to the demon himself. Now, there's only one devil. Sometimes the King James confuses this and translates the same word or different words, devil and demon, as devils. There's only one devil, Lucifer. There are many demons through the hierarchy, fallen angels, or through the hierarchy. Only one devil. This man had an unclean spirit, which was a demon. And when Jesus was seen, I guess this demon could come in the container, which was the apparent worshiper in the synagogue, and never be recognized, never give himself away. He was present in the synagogue, every Sabbath day, worshiping God just like the other believers. And I've seen them in churches the same way. But when Jesus came on the scene, this demon, whose existence predates Eden, in the recreative period, whose existence goes clear back to the beginning in the councils of heaven before the earth were formed, who knew Jesus in his preeminent position
as well as he knew Lucifer in his previous preeminent position, instantly recognizes who's there. And the demon takes the voice over and begins to speak. And he cried out, saying, "Let us alone. What have we to do with thee?" Plural, one man speaking. "Thou Jesus of Nazareth, art thou come to destroy us? I know thee who thou art, thou Holy One of God." And Jesus rebuked him, saying, "Hold thy peace and come out of him." And when the unclean spirit had torn him, thrown him on the ground, in a fit, and cried with a loud voice, he came out of him. You go on and you'll find in just about every chapter, he's meeting demons. And he will find some demons later in the chapter who say to him, "Art thou come to send us to the abyss before our time?" Knowing that that's where they're going to go ultimately. But there's some that are loose and they don't want to go there yet. When he comes upon the demoniac boy of the Gadarenes, the demons in him cry out, "We be legion." And they beg Jesus that they not be sent to the abyss, but rather be allowed to enter into the pigs that were kept on that side. And the pigs, when the demons went into them, having been allowed by Jesus, went crazy and ran into the lake and drowned themselves. What's the point? These demons exist. Earthly nations are under the power of evil princes, and you and I suffer today as God is leading the way back through his redemptive plan. Not only the grip of sin that is on our lives, having been separated from God until the barrier was broken, we suffer the state of beings on this earth that was created for Adam and his descendants, that was lost because Adam and Eve chose to trust Satan. And this territory, the whole earth, is like Kuwait, illegally occupied, but occupied through treachery. And because Adam, to whom it was given, let him have it. Listen to him instead of God. Part of the punishment was to deny that dominion to man and let Satan have it. And the redemptive plan is rescuing those of us that have acted in faith and received the gift of his Spirit from this earth. And the final battle of Armageddon will have Christ come with the saints behind him to put down the final expression of evil on this earth, crystallized and focused in Antichrist, possessed of demons, and a false prophet who gets his message under the guise of looking like Jesus and being a churchman will get his message from the same old deceiving dragon, Satan. Now in Daniel chapter 8 and 9, and I'm coming quickly to a close, and in a sense, I guess this message will be an introduction to what I finish next Sunday, if the same people will just be here so I can pick up where I leave off. Daniel is praying. In the 9th chapter, he says, "I set my face unto the Lord God to seek by prayer and supplication with fasting and sackcloth and ashes." In the 10th chapter, toward the end of the 9th chapter, Gabriel appears to him and begins to prophesy. In the 10th chapter, the angel appears after three full weeks of fasting and prayer. In the 5th verse of the 10th chapter, Daniel says, "I lifted up mine eyes and looked, and behold, a certain man clothed in linen, whose loins were girded with fine gold of Uphaz, his body like the beryl, face as the appearance of lightning, his eyes as lamps of fire, his arms and feet like in color to polished brass, and the voice of his words like the voice of a multitude."
a great quaking fell upon the men with Daniel, and they fled to hide themselves. And he says, I was left alone. There remained no strength in me. Yet heard I the voice of words. A hand touched me, set me upon my knees and upon the palms of my hands, said unto me, O Daniel, stand upright. Fear not, verse 12, for from the first day that thou didst set thine heart to understand and to chasten thyself before thy God, thy words were heard, and I am come for thy words. 3 weeks earlier, this powerful angel that produced the quaking in his appearance and lifted Daniel up says, 3 weeks ago I heard, and I'm come because of your prayer. But the prince of the kingdom of Persia withstood me 1 and 20 days. Below Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me, and I remained there with the kings of Persia. Now I am come to make thee understand what shall befall thy people in the latter days. 3 weeks Daniel is praying and fasting. 3 weeks. Gabriel heard the message 3 weeks ago. Coming with the message, he was withstood with the princes of Persia. We know and have the clue these are not earthly princes because Michael comes to help him. And Michael is called one of the chief princes. So we know we're talking about angelic princes, evil angels, and in the case of Gabriel and Michael, angels on God's side. 3 weeks, these evil princes under Satan in his hierarchy, just as Satan ruled the king of Tyre and the king of Babylon, he rules Persia. And these principalities and powers, as Paul would refer to them in the New Testament, wickedness in high places, had sufficient power that though mankind would quake and fall when they appeared, and Daniel would fall to his face, these evil princes had such power that Gabriel alone, and had I 3 hours this morning, I would talk about the prayer at Jerusalem when one angel came and slew 180,000 of Sennacherib's finest troops in one night. I would talk of the prophet in the book of Kings who is going and he has his servant with him and they see an earthly battle array in front of him and he's terrorized. And the prophet prays, Lord, open his eyes. And God deigns to do it, and he sees the hills about covered with the army of the Lord, invisible warriors for God. These powerful superhuman beings, princes of Persia who disguise themselves in the earthly being through whom they rule, these princes, I don't want any more movement in here. Don't you all know this service goes till 1 o'clock?
Yes, sir.
Don't come unless you expect to stay. If you've got weak kidneys, sit in the back. I'm tired of the movement. How many of you know when you bring guests, you're supposed to educate them? This is a university classroom. You are not here to move about just because you want to move. And if you're bored by what I'm saying, it's a state of your mentality that can't follow a message of this kind of intensity. So don't reveal how stupid you are, but continuing to walk. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
I don't like engineers, and I don't like traveling audiences. By the way, I can see reflections, too, when I turn my back. Remember that. These princes of Persia resisted Gabriel. He couldn't get through them until Michael came. And Michael helped him defeat him until at the end of this chapter, he says, having delivered the message, I go back and we fight against these princes of Persia and there'll be no more. Lo, the prince of Grecia comes. Now, in the book of Revelation, Antichrist will come to power with regional conflicts. That's told us in Daniel 11. And he takes his shape in the book of Revelation
as the seventh kingdom that oppresses Israel. That same earthly being takes a different tone and thus becomes the eighth kingdom oppressing Israel, when out of this same abyss, an evil demon will be released from the bottomless pit, a beast it's called, that was and is not in John's time and will be, that had previously possessed one of the past kingdoms that oppressed Israel, my choice being, as I said last Sunday, so buy that tape, the prince of Grecia that possessed Alexander the Great. And that evil demon will come out of the abyss and possess Antichrist, the earthly ruler, drive him to perdition, and set the stage for Armageddon, when Christ will come to put him down, and Satan will be cast into this same abyss for 1,000 years, and millennium is ushered in. In that same description period in the book of Revelation, not only are demons released out of the abyss to work havoc in the last days, which hasn't yet happened, there are 200 million of these evil princes that will be released in the area of Babylon, led by four terrible and powerful princes that are chained, bound in the air above Babylon. Now just think about it. We've not been able to conceive the evil that came out of Iraq when their holy man would rejoice over the dead bodies of those that went in to rescue the hostages. We've not been able to adjust our civilized mind to the evil and madness of Saddam Hussein. If we don't know history, but if we do know history, we'll find the same problem. If we don't know history, it looks like it's new on the scene. But to those of us that know history, it's just as difficult to comprehend Sennacherib, Babylon, the Medo-Persian Empire, the evil that's come out of that area, and the successor to Alexander the Great, the Seleucid kings, to the evil of Antiochus Epiphanes, who wanted himself to be worshipped as he conquered Palestine. The whole area has been nothing but a constant poison well of evil against the revelation of God's truth and his redemptive plan. Paul, by some human quirk, wanted to go to Asia. God, through his Spirit, turned him around. And with an angel, another one of those superhuman beings, with an angel at Troas, sends him instead to the Celtic peoples of Peloponnesia and sends his message west. Because God knows, from the days of Nimrod, the great rebel who built Babylon, this has been a stronghold of Satan and his henchmen, and that the beastly kingdoms to whom God gave 7 times control in succession kingdoms portrayed in Scripture as beastly kingdoms down to the nondescript beast that in the apocryphal book of Esdras takes the form of the three-headed eagle. This is the stronghold of Satan. I repeat what I said last Sunday. Doesn't mean individuals can't be saved therein. And it is my experience in years of mission work that the Christians of that area, because of the forces of evil that rule, to survive, represent individually some of the brightest expressions of true Christianity. But this territory of Satan and his minions, to the very last day, will be the territory, the bunker, if you will, from which Satan in his earthly campaigns operates.
I've said, and you need the two previous messages. Saddam is not Antichrist. He's a forerunner. He's a prototype. I can say what Jesus said in the Gospels when he said, you can watch the signs and know that the time of the end is near. And when certain ones go by, you can say the time is not yet. The time is not yet. Saddam Hussein has thrown the gauntlet down prematurely. And this war will be won. And won by the people of God. And like it or lump it, God will always have a raid against the devil and his turf in this area. Even people that don't believe in God will find themselves inextricably pulled in union. The United States, Great Britain, and the northwestern nations in Europe inevitably will find themselves joined against this evil. And Egypt, no matter how much it tries to be part of the Pan-Arab League, will always find itself arrayed against this king of the north. And all that is happening, instead of making men and women lose faith, to those who know their Bible, it should increase our faith as we see God working what he has prophesied. We see the pattern unfolding, and this prototype of Antichrist will be defeated, as I've said, by the people of God. And as I pick up this message next Sunday at this point, I will demonstrate through the stream of history that Britain and the United States are indeed, whether they know it or like it, just as literally as Israel could depart from the faith, but God chose them to be his oracle, and he would make their life fulfill his purposes in spite of themselves. The United States and Great Britain will always be together with restored Israel against this stronghold of Satan that continues to be occupied with changing disguises, whether it was the king of Tyre, the king of Babylon, or whomever else may be ruling to the present Ayatollahs and Saddams. They will be defeated. It's going to be painful, and it's going to be bloody. But Saddam is not Antichrist. We are not at the threshold of Armageddon. A man of peace must come on the scene. A contract of peace, which Israel accepts, must be negotiated, and the world must have its guard dropped, crying peace and safety, with someone in the disguise of a peacemaker ruling in this area, before out of the abyss will come the demon that possessed Alexander the Great with the supernatural powers we have preached this message to illustrate, and possess him and drive him to perdition. And to the world's surprise, he will attack Israel. And we'll be gone. And we'll come back when Jesus comes to the plain of Megiddo to execute his final judgment on Antichrist. Therefore, the time is not yet. Saddam did not come as a peacemaker. He's here as a troublemaker, and he's going to get whipped. And the people of God, in spite of themselves, are fulfilling their destiny. And you might not like to think of us with our boys in the sands and our planes ditching in the Indian Ocean. But the end of time is already written by God, and this blessed nation, United States, and that blessed kingdom, Britain, and that restored nation, Israel, must always have this role, because out of this stronghold, evil will flow and continue to flow until, learning that force won't work, he adopts the disguise of the peacemaker. Then look for Antichrist
This ain't the time. You're seeing a prototype. We're going to win this war. Look up. God's in control. Our redemption draweth nigh. And Jake, come and sing that wonderful song again for the boys who will hear it in the Gulf and know. And I don't know why preachers are so gutless on this side of the fence that know their Bible, to let some madman claim that God's on his side when the record of God's book shows that has been the seat of Satan's kingdom, and 200 million demons will be turned loose in that area in the last days. I don't know why preachers are so godless as to say and lack the courage to say God's book, which we preach, says God's on our side and we're going to win in the name of the Lord. So sing America the Beautiful. Offering time. Come on, ushers.
Skies, for amber waves of grain, for purple mountains, majesties above the fruited plain. America, America, God shed His on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea. Oh, beautiful, for heroes proved in liberation. For more than self, their country loved, and mercy more than life. America, America, may God thy gold refine. Till all success be nobleness, and every gain divine. America, America, God shed His grace on thee and crown thy good with brotherhood from sea to shining sea.